Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm pleased to welcome you to this teleconsultation on the U.S. Federal Reserve update on the fundamentals of internal audit. I am Fu Bun Ping, the managing editor of the Asian Banker. This morning, we're very happy that we have Mei Lim, senior risk specialist at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, to update us on the latest regulation from the Federal Reserve on internal audit, as well as internal control and outsourcing. Before May does her presentation, let me give a brief background on the topic. According to the Institute of Internal Auditors, the internal audit function serves the crucial role of providing senior management with comprehensive assurance, or what is better known as the third and final line of defense in the three lines of defense model of risk management. Of course, we know the first line being management control, and the second line comprises the various risk controls and compliance oversight functions established by management. Hence, internal audit, based on the highest level of independence and objectivity within the organization, provides assurance on the effectiveness of governance, risk management, and internal controls, including the manner in which the first and second lines of defense achieve risk management and control objectives. The international regulatory community, such as the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision, have revised and issued new supervisory guidance for assessing the effectiveness of the internal audit functions in banks. This forms part of regulators' ongoing efforts to address bank supervisory issues and enhance supervision through guidance that encourages sound practices within banks. It takes into account developments in supervisory practices and in banking organization and incorporate lessons drawn from the global financial crisis. The document builds on the committee's principle for enhancing corporate governance, which requires banks to have an internal audit function with sufficient authority, stature, independence, resources, and access to the board of directors. Independent, competent, and qualified internal auditors are central to sound corporate governance. The document is based on 20 principles organized in three sections. The first, supervisory expectation relevant to the internal audit function. Second, the relationship of the supervisory authority with the internal audit function. And third, supervisory assessment of the internal audit function. This approach seeks to promote a strong internal audit function within banking organization. It also encourages bank internal auditors to comply with and to contribute to the development of national and international professional standards. And it promotes due consideration of prudential issues in the development of internal audit standards and practices. Regulators in Asia Pacific have also kept pace. The Monetary Authority of Singapore and the Hong Kong Monetary Authority have also similarly revised and issued updates, such as the Guideline on Risk Management Practices on Internal Controls and Guidelines on Corporate Governance from the MAS. And HKMA has also come up with a Supervisory Policy Manual on Internal Audit Functions to inform and provide guidance to banks on the internal audit functions, among other sound practices for internal controls. In 2013, the U.S. Federal Reserve System issued a supplemental policy statement, SR13-1, to accompany earlier interagency guidance from 2003 on the internal audit function and its outsourcing, SR03-5. The new guidance was issued in order to keep pace with changes in internal control processes and today's global operating environment, and is partly in response to the global financial crisis. It is applicable to institutions with consolidated assets of greater than $10 billion. Today's teleconsultation will review the guidance and share examples of how banks have implemented the guidance. Specifically, it will discuss the evolving framework of the internal audit function, examine the role of the internal auditor, the architecture and governance structure of internal audit, monitoring performance to plan, and outsourcing arrangement. We're glad to have Mei Ling to share with us the update. Mei Ling is a senior risk specialist at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. She is responsible for a portfolio of regional institutions between 10 and 50 billion in total assets overseen by the Federal Reserve Bank. Her responsibilities include evaluating the effectiveness of internal and external audit programs, enterprise-wide risk management processes, and internal control systems in accordance with supervisory guidance and industry practice. May is also an active contributor to the audit and financial control work group, which is part of the Federal Reserve System's accounting communications network. Prior to the Federal Reserve, May was the Vice President of Corporate Audit Department at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. After May's presentation will be followed by a Q&A session where we'll continue to explore the topic. So now let me invite May to start with her presentation on the fundamentals of internal audit.
Thank you, Boonping, for the introduction. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen in Asia, and for our fellow participants from the United States, a very good evening. My name is Mei Lim, and I will be your presenter for the next 45 minutes. I would like to express that the opinions within this presentation are of my own personal statements and are not formal opinions of the Federal Reserve System. The presentation is intended only for informational purposes. First, within this presentation, there are a few abbreviations that I would like to address. Supervision and regulation letters will be referred to as SR letters or SR. Chief Audit Executive, General Auditor, Audit Director will be referred to as CAE. Institute of Internal Auditors will be referred to as IIA. So let's go ahead and get started. On the first slide, after the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve's supervisor experience during and following the financial crisis, Federal Reserve staff identified areas for improving regulated institutions' internal audit functions. Therefore, the existing guidance was updated to reflect the current expectations, and the supplemental policy statement was created. This new guidance addresses the characteristics, governance, and operational effectiveness of an institution's internal audit function. Federal Reserve's key priorities are to evaluate the effectiveness of internal audit and to identify areas of opportunities where our examiners can leverage the work of internal audit. Now, on slide 3, you will see the Federal Reserve issued internal audit references. And later on the next slide, you will notice that there are other internal audit related references listed. The aim of these references was to enhance regulated institutions' internal audit practices and to encourage them to adopt Federal Reserve issued letters, professional audit standards, and other guidelines such as those issued by the IIA. So we're going to move through slide 5. Let's visit what is this SR letter 13-1 and how does it relate to internal audit. First, let's define internal audit. Internal audit is an independent and objective function that supports the organization's business objectives and evaluates the effectiveness of risk management, internal controls, and governance processes. Throughout this presentation, you will hear me say risk management, internal controls, and governance processes quite a bit. I'm often asked, what's the difference between the 2003 policy statement or SR 03-5, and SR letter 13-1. Well, before I answer that question, let me recap what is this 2003 policy statement. It outlines the key characteristics of an internal audit function, sound practices concerning the use of outsourcing vendors, and the effect outsourcing arrangements have on the independence of an external auditor who also provides internal audit services. Now, SR 13-1 is the supplemental policy that builds upon the 2003 policy statement, which still, by the way, remains in effect. And there's a new section added entitled enhance internal audit practices, which we will discuss later in this presentation. Now, on this slide, I'm going to talk about the attributes of an internal audit function. There are four key areas that make up the framework. First, there should be an internal audit charter that is established. The charter should include critical components such as the objectives of the function, internal audit's reporting line, the chief audit executive's roles and responsibilities, and internal audit's responsibility to evaluate the effectiveness of the institution's risk management, internal controls, and governance process. The charter should be approved by the audit committee of the board of directors. Secondly, internal audit has to be an independent function. To do this, it is important that the CAE reports directly to the audit committee and administratively to the CEO. The CAE should have no responsibility operating any sort of system of internal control. For any arrangements where the CAE reports administratively to someone other than the CEO, the audit committee should document its rationale for this reporting structure, including any mitigating controls available for situations that could impact the objectivity of the CAE. Thirdly, internal auditors should be objective, which means performing assignments that are free from bias and interference. Even though an internal auditor may recommend internal control enhancements, the internal auditor should not be responsible for the design and implementation of the internal control. Internal audit should also have code of ethics. Code of ethics emphasizes the principles of objectivity, competence, confidentiality, and integrity. A separate code of ethics is not required if the bank has a similar code drafted. Lastly, internal audit staff should have the relevant skill set to audit all areas of the institution, whether it's through the years of audit and industry-specific experience, maybe educational background, professional certifications, and so forth. The staff should be assigned to the areas of expertise. From what we've seen, a typical audit training program is generally in the range of 30 to 40 hours. I would say that there will be a caveat. If the audit staff is involved in a Bank Secrecy Act review or an information technology audit, the auditor is expected to focus his or her training in that area. On slide 7, we are often asked, what is corporate governance and who is considered part of corporate governance? Well, for starters, the board of directors and senior management are the key players in corporate governance. They are responsible for ensuring that the institution has an effective system of internal controls. This responsibility cannot be delegated to others within the institution or to external parties. Now, there is also the audit committee, who is part of corporate governance. As Boonping previously mentioned, they are the third line of defense. They are responsible for establishing an appropriate internal audit function and ensuring that the function operates adequately and effectively. The audit committee is also expected to retain oversight responsibility for any aspects of the internal audit function that's outsourced to a third party. The audit committee is also responsible for hiring the CAE, his or her annual performance evaluation, and compensation. Reporting to the audit committee is the CAE. This is the person who is responsible for managing the internal audit function and for communicating and reporting to the audit committee on all audit-related matters, such as audit performance to plan, audit issues, any deviations to audit policy, and so forth. He or she is responsible for developing and maintaining a quality assurance and improvement program that covers all aspects of internal audit activity, and continuously monitoring the effectiveness of the audit function, not limited to the work that is outsourced. Now let's open up the line to see if we have any questions from the callers.
May, you mentioned about the code of ethics for internal audit. Now, in most banks, there is a general code of conduct for employees and staff. So the proposal is for internal audit to have a separate set of code of ethics, or rather than a separate, an additional code on top of existing code of conduct.
No, if the institution has their own code of ethics, internal audit can use the same document or just build upon that version and include internal audit references.
And the chief audit executive, does he administratively have to report to the chief executive officer? Can he report to someone other than the chief executive officer?
Yes, the CAE can actually report to someone other than the CEO. However, it's not preferable if the chief audit executive were to report to, for example, the chief financial officer, just because of Sarbanes-Oxley implementation and implication, as the CAE is also responsible for auditing that area. Now, I would also say that the CAE should also have no responsibility operating any sort of system of internal control. And if such arrangement were to happen, then the audit committee, A, needs to approve this arrangement. And the second thing that we require is to document the rationale for this reporting structure as to, why is the CAE not able to report to the CEO.
Okay, so the function of the CAE is purely in terms of monitoring and reviewing existing controls or proposed new controls. Is there a distinction between the CAE and the audit committee?
Yes, so the CAE's role is to support the audit committee. So the audit committee role would be at a high level, approving audit plans, approving risk assessment, approving the audit methodology. Now, the CAE is delegated to execute the audit plan and run the audit function as part of his responsibility, roles and responsibility defined by the audit charter.
Okay, I want to give some instructions for our callers. If you're interested to ask a question, you have two options to do so. You can either write your questions in the chat box at the bottom right corner of the WebEx screen, or you can press the hand icon in the list of attendees at the right column of your screen. This will register your intention to speak and will open the line for you. So meanwhile, I don't see any more questions coming in. So May, I think you can continue with your presentation.
All right, thank you, Boonping, and thank you for those questions. Now, on slide 9, there are 5 key areas where internal audit is responsible for. First and foremost, internal audit has to establish policy and procedures to guide internal audit staff. The policy and procedures should be consistent with the size and complexity of the department and institution. Next is the audit methodology. Internal audit should ensure that it has a well-developed risk assessment methodology that drives the risk assessment process. The methodology should include analysis of cross-institutional risk and thematic control issues and addresses its procedures for evaluating effectiveness of risk management. At a minimum, the audit methodology should cover the following: risk assessment, audit plan, sampling selection methodology, testing documentation, including work paper review and sign-off, audit reports, issues tracking, and quality assurance programs. For the topics of work paper standards, quality assurance, and managing outsourcing arrangements, I will touch upon in the upcoming slides. On slide 10, internal audit, let's talk about establishing internal audit universe. Internal audit should have a process to identify all auditable entities within the audit universe. The audit universe should be documented and reviewed at least annually to ensure that it captures any significant organizational changes that occur during the audit plan year. Internal audit should establish an audit frequency for all the auditable entities. Typically, high-risk areas should be reviewed every 12 to 18 months, medium-risk areas 18 to 24 months, and low-risk areas 24 to 36 months. Depending on the size of the institution, the frequency of these audits should be determined only after the risk assessment is completed. There are instances where lower-risk areas are reviewed within a 4 to 5 year cycle. I would discuss the role of continuous monitoring in slide 12. Audit risk assessment. This should reflect the institution's significant business activities and the associated risks. These assessments analyze inherent risks given the business line and the mitigating controls resulting in the residual risk exposure to the institution. There should be a discipline in place to ensure that the risk assessments become an ongoing process in which objectives, risk response measures, and controls are regularly re-evaluated. The risk assessment process represents the cornerstone of an effective audit program. Note that the risk assessment cannot be merely a checklist or a process that is disconnected from the business strategic plan and internal controls. The risk assessment should also consider any thematic control issues, risk tolerance, and governance within the institution. When the risk assessment indicates a change in risk, the audit plan should be reviewed to determine whether the planned audit coverage should be increased or decreased to address the revised assessment of risk. Let's talk about developing an audit plan. Internal audit plan should also be dynamic, and there should be a process established to modify the plan, adjusting any significant changes that are identified either through continuous monitoring or after completion of an audit. Any significant changes should be clearly documented and communicated to the audit committee. In addition, any deferred or canceled audits rated high risk, additions, changes to the audit budget, or timeliness for completion of audit should be reported to the audit committee. Continuous monitoring. I often get asked this question, what is continuous monitoring? Well, here's my interpretation. Internal audit process to monitor key business processes and internal control and has ongoing insight into the effectiveness of controls and the integrity of transactions running within them. How does the continuous monitoring processes drive changes in the audit risk assessment and or the audit plan? Well, I can tell you this. Different institutions employ a variety of different techniques. Just to name a few is by attending various committee meetings of the institution, whether it's risk management, asset liability management, or any financial meetings, and have periodic discussions with business leaders. This information should be used to inform the risk assessment process. For example, at some institutions, I've seen that there is an audit staff that is assigned to monitor consumer compliance or audit staff that's aligned to monitor information technology. On a monthly basis, this audit staff attends the line of business meetings and also enrolls themselves in the specific business unit training. This is so that he or she keeps informed about the business. Especially as larger banks, typically above 50 billion, the audit department is aligned very closely to the business unit structure. The other question I get a lot is, also, what is the difference between continuous monitoring and continuous auditing? First, let me define what continuous monitoring means. Well, actually, let me take that back. Let me define what continuous auditing means. Continuous auditing is where audit performs auditing activities on a frequent, repeated basis to provide ongoing assurance and more timely insight into risk and controls. So I would say, in short, automation of routine audit procedures. Now, the concept has evolved. Oftentimes, change occurs in tandem with technological advancements. It is clear now that it's beneficial for audit to use current technology on an ongoing basis, whether it is a spreadsheet to sort data or a bar graph to show outliers. A typical test is used of analytics to test all transactions against a comprehensive range of control rules. Typically, statistical and profiling analysis is performed, looking for indications of risk and control problems that may not be addressed through existing controls. This could involve a trend analysis around, for example, payroll, in identifying when pay rates in one department become unusually high, or when payments are being made to employees who are terminated. By implementing continuous monitoring, there can be proven quantifiable reduction in errors, such as duplicate payments or incorrect payments, as well as revenue leakages and fraud instances. Setting up continuous auditing and continuous monitoring requires involvement of a cross-section of the organization. Auditors, business owners, representatives from finance, compliance, and the most important group of them all is information technology. You need them to get access to data. I don't deny that establishing comprehensive continuous auditing and continuous monitoring processes is a step that should not be taken lightly. As like anything else, it involves time, personnel, and resources. However, when implemented properly, the benefits will justify the investment. I have a reference which is not identified within the deck. It's by the IIA Global Technology Audit Guide number 3. It has references to continuous auditing, specifically implication for assurance, monitoring, and risk assessment. So please check out that guidance. Moving on to audit scope. Audit scope is information that's gathered during the audit planning process, which should be used to determine the scope and specific audit steps that should be performed to test the adequacy of the design and operating effectiveness of the control process. Oftentimes, regulatory guidance is used to help develop the audit steps. On slide 13, we're going to talk about two topics, audit work papers and audit report. Let's start with audit work papers. This is basically documentation of the work performed, supporting the observation, analysis, conclusions, and findings. The work papers have to contain sufficient information regarding the fulfillment of the scope, any program modifications, or better known as out of scope, and waiver of issues if not included in the final report. Work papers should also document the sampling methodology used, statistical, random, judgmental, haphazard, the sample sizes, and the rationale for using that methodology. A comprehensive supervisory review should also be performed on all audit work, including work that has been outsourced. Different institutions have different review processes. In smaller shops, typically the audit manager reviews the work papers and signs off upon completion of his or her review. In larger shops, the auditor in charge and manager review the work papers. Audit report. The audit report should include an executive summary that describes what the scope of review was, the audit conclusions, rationale for those conclusions, and any key issues identified with ratings attached. Most audit reports include management action plans and the corrective action dates. To ensure that the issues are addressed timely, reports should be issued to the affected business area, senior management, and the audit committee within an appropriate time frame upon completion of fieldwork. Compliance with issuance timeframes should be monitored and reported to the audit committee. On slide 14, we're going to discuss audit issues tracking and retrospective review processes. On audit issues tracking, internal audit should have a process in place to track and monitor all issues, follow up on any outstanding issues, aggregate issues, and report trends. The timely remediation of open issues is also an essential component of an organization's risk reduction efforts. Normally, before an audit report is issued, the responsible management discusses and agree on the appropriate resolution date and the corrective action plans. When the issue owner has completed their corrective action plan, internal audit should perform validation testing prior to closing the issue. Especially for higher risk issues, internal audit should perform and document substantive testing to validate that the issue has been resolved and is tested over a period of time to ensure the sustainability of the remediation. Retrospective review process. When a fraud or an adverse event occurs, management should conduct a lesson learned analysis. Oftentimes, internal audit gets asked or questioned, why didn't they detect this or prevent this? Internal audit should evaluate management analysis of the reasons for the event and whether the adverse event was a result of a control breakdown or failure,
and identify measures that should be put in place to prevent a similar event from occurring, including improvements to the internal audit test program. Slide 15 talks about internal and external quality assurance, or QA, processes. Internal audit should develop a comprehensive QA program to ensure that the internal audit activities conform to the IIA's professional standards and to the institution's internal audit policies and procedures. The program should include both internal and external assessments. The objective of an internal assessment is to promote and assess the quality and consistency of the audit work with respect to policy and procedures, audit performance, and work papers. I've seen various institutions have an internal QA department that reviews a sample of internal audit work anywhere from quarterly to annually. On the external quality assessment, IIA recommends that the external review be performed by a qualified independent party at least once every 5 years. The review should address compliance with the IIA's definition of internal auditing, code of ethics, standards, charter, policy and procedures, just to name a few. Upon completion of both internal and external QA, the CAE should communicate the results and any planned remediation efforts to senior management and the audit committee. On slide 16, we're going to talk about co-source and outsource audit as well as contingency plan. Now, some institutions may not have the capacity or the necessary skill set to execute their plan. Therefore, the need to outsource or co-source the audits to a third-party vendor. The audit committee and the CAE should provide active and effective oversight of outsourced activities. The audit committee should also approve all significant aspects of outsourcing arrangements and receive information on audit deficiencies consistently. This arrangement should function no different than if the audit staff was in-house. Note that the responsibility for maintaining an effective system of internal controls cannot be delegated to a third party. It is the responsibility of the audit committee who maintains ownership of the internal audit function. Contingency plan. When an institution heavily relies on the resources of an external provider, the institution should have contingency procedures for managing temporary and permanent disruptions and to ensure that the internal audit function can still meet its intended objectives. Looks like we are at a good stopping point, so let's perhaps take some questions from the callers over the phone.
Okay, made some interesting points that you brought up. Are there particular examples of appropriate level of issue validation you mentioned? You also mentioned the retrospective review processes, lesson learned. Are there practical examples of how this are being done and any cases that you can share with us?
So I'm going to first address the first question, which is examples, from what I was hearing correctly, examples of appropriate level of issue validation.
Okay. Right.
So for higher risk level issues, typically there should be some kind of substantive testing, and what that means is there should be some sampling performed over a period of time. Typically, internal audit should have a set of sampling methodology to remediate the issue. So just as an example, they would test annually, they would test one sample. Quarterly, they would test two samples for the year. For daily, they would test 25 to 35. And this is just a personal opinion where I've seen across different institutions. Mm-hmm. So make sure that the testing or the sampling is over a period of time and there is some kind of sustainability within that control. Now, for your second question on postmortem review or retrospective review process, for us, there isn't a prescribed timeline or a prescribed strategy on how they would go about doing that test. It would actually depend on the significance of the issue, especially if it's a fraud event. More time would be spent on investigating and reviewing that event versus if it was a policy and procedure type of issue. And most audit departments actually have a timeline allocated for these sort of unexpected events or review. I hope that answers the question.
Okay. A related question to that is you mentioned also about continuous monitoring and continuous auditing, right? And the need for the internal audit team to have relevant experience to understand and evaluate the business as well as the control processes. Now, on a practical level, are there examples of how the different internal audit teams or internal audit functions are set up? And if there are, could you share some of those with our callers?
And can I just rephrase your question? Are you talking about continuous monitoring at different institutions?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I can answer that question. So I would have to say it differs from institution to institution on the type of techniques that are used in terms of continuous monitoring. And a few things, as I previously mentioned, was, you know, attending different meetings, committee-related meetings at the organization. So, you know, at a bank, typically you would attend the asset liability meeting, you attend the credit meeting, you attend different subgroups that the banks may have so that internal auditors can stay informed if there's a change in the management structure, there's a new product that's coming, or there's a change in the process. You know, internal audit needs to be there to hear that, you know, for the first time so that they can embed that in their risk assessments and maybe reprioritize their audit from a lower risk. All of a sudden, they have a new infrastructure in place, so they're going to push that up to a medium or high risk and to get that evaluated a lot quicker than originally intended.
Okay. And are there examples of audit frequency for the different risk level?
Yeah, so basically
you mentioned some time frame, right? So
yeah, I did, and so I'm assuming that you know, if the institution works on a three-prong scale, which I said, you know, low, medium, and high, and there are other institutions that use a five-prong scale, you know, they use a low to moderate, moderate to high, and it's gonna vary. So the typical frequency that I've seen is lower risks are going to be handled within a 4 to 5 year range. And then your medium risks are typically going to be in your 18 to 24 months. And some people, they do stretch it to 36 months. But the high risks, we actually don't have much tolerance for anything over 18 months, meaning, you know, don't start your audits in the 18th month, but it has to be finished with a report issued by the 18th month. So 12 to 18 is pretty much a solid frequency for high-risk environment.
Great. Okay. May, I think you can continue with the presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Boonping. Moving on slide 18, as previously stated, SR 13-1 or the Supplemental Policy Statement builds upon the 2003 Policy Statement, and we're going to talk about the new section, which is Enhanced Internal Audit Practices, which is broken down into six key areas. So let's take a look at the first item, which is risk analysis on slide 19. So what is risk analysis? This is an enhanced practice suggested that internal audit should analyze all critical risk management functions with respect to individual risk dimensions. And examples of risk dimensions would be strategic, financial, operational, compliance, and just to name a few, there's a couple more, and the institution's overall risk management function. The analysis would consider the impact of risks to the institution as a basis to define the audit plan and monitor key risks. This top-down approach enables the coverage of internal audit activities to be driven by issues that directly impact the shareholder and customer value,
with clear and explicit linkage to strategic drivers for the organization. Well, I'm going to simplify this into three parts. The first part is that the analysis should focus on monitoring compliance with established policies and procedures and any applicable laws and regulations. The second part is questioning whether the monitoring processes are appropriate for the business activities and associated risks. This also ties in into a later slide on the topic of challenging management and policy. The third part is evaluating the overall risk management function. How is the institution managing and monitoring the risk horizontally, and if the monitoring processes are appropriate for the bank's business activities? The next topic is thematic control issues, or known as systematic issues. A lot of our institutions in our district attempt to implement this guideline, and I've received a lot of questions on this topic. I simply tell our banks that these are issues that have an overall impact on the institution's risk profile. I also broke this out into two categories. First is the micro issue, and second is the macro issue. A micro issue is normally identified as a result of an audit and may be narrow and specific to a particular risk. Macro issues is sort of like grand scheme of things, overarching theme, enterprise level type of issue, which has a more horizontal implication. It may be at a broad and higher level view, considering strategic, operational, reporting, and compliance risks, and can be used to drill down further into a specific area of concern. I'm going to give you an example. Typically, we'll find user access control issues within several audit areas: wire department audit, accounting, finance audit, retail branches, and so forth. Oftentimes, these issues have an overarching theme, or the heart of the issue, or the root cause is due to a policy deficiency at the institution level. So in this case, the main concern is that the enterprise-wide user access control policy requires improvements or needs revision. On slide 20, there are two topics that we're going to discuss: challenge management and policy, as well as infrastructure. Challenging management, what does that mean? Well, internal audit should always challenge management to adopt appropriate policy and procedures and effective controls. If audit deems that controls are insufficient in a particular line of business activity, audit should report these deficiencies to the audit committee. Internal audit should also monitor management's corrective actions and conduct a follow-up review to confirm that the recommendations of both internal audit and the audit committee have been addressed. Infrastructure. If the institution is purchasing a new software or maybe offering a new product, internal audit should review significant changes and notify management of potential internal control issues. In particular, internal audit should ensure the existing effective internal controls, for example, software application or management information system reporting, are not rendered ineffective as a result of infrastructure changes unless those controls are compensated for by other mitigating controls. Typically, this can be achieved by performing a pre-implementation review or a post-implementation review. On slide 11, we'll discuss risk tolerance. Internal audit should understand the risks faced by the institution and evaluate that the board and senior management are actively involved in setting and monitoring compliance with the institution's risk tolerance limits. Where audit comes in is that they would periodically evaluate the reasonableness of established limits and perform testing that management is operating within those limits. Under governance and strategic objectives, internal audit should evaluate governance at all management levels within the institution, and this is not limited to senior management level only, the adequacy and effectiveness of the controls related to the institution's risks, and any concerns should be communicated to the board and senior management. This pretty much sums up the enhanced internal audit practice session. So let's open the lines for any questions.
Ms. May, earlier you mentioned about the thematic control issues. You talk about the macro and the micro, and you gave some examples of them. In terms of mitigating some of these issues, are the approach similar or the approaches are slightly different depending on whether they are macro or micro?
I would say that it depends, and I don't like giving that type of answer, but normally macro issues are broader in nature, so it would require probably a longer corrective action plan because it's at a horizontal level. So you're talking about a bank that's $50 billion, there are a couple of gatekeepers that you need to go through to approve, you know, whether it's a new policy that needs to be implemented or a new process that needs to be enhanced. Now, at a micro level, it's specifically maybe a business type issue. So it could be easily fixed and remediated through the normal course of action, either by just updating their current processes or, you know, just adding new controls, which is a simple fix, I would say. So now, in terms of validation, it's going to differ because, you know, the macro issue is going to require a little bit more testing than you would of a minor issue or a smaller issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and on that topic on challenging management and policy, when there is a control that is not put in place or policy that has not been followed, right, what type of information should be provided to the audit committee? And I also have got a fundamental question as well. Are there overlaps between audit and compliance and legal in some instances when kind of challenging or when you highlight non-compliance or where there are certain policies that are not followed, and what are the distinctions?
Okay, I'm going to try to dissect your question a little bit here. So the first question was around challenging management when there is a non-compliance to a policy. How does that get escalated up to the audit committee? That's a very actually simple answer, which is, you know, the audit that identified those issues should be included in an audit report, and the audit report should be, you know, escalated to the audit committee. Now that's one. Two, you know, it's a very, you know, audit plays a very gray area. You know, sometimes, you know, especially for compliance-related, non-compliance or compliance-related issue, it's very difficult to write the audit report or cite that finding per se. And what audit normally has to do is go back to the regulation. Is it a yes or no? Are they in compliance or no? So it's pretty black and white when it comes to compliance. So there should be no leeway in not reporting that issue or not including that in the audit report.
Okay. I think we have a question here. For private sector, their principal focus, professional standards that provide a framework for an effective and disciplined service. Can such standard be successfully applied to the role of a bank internal auditors?
Can you please
guess
that
is sure. For private sectors, there are principal focused professional standards that provide a framework for an effective and disciplined service. Can such standards be successfully applied to the role of bank internal auditors? So I guess those are professional, like the IIA standards. Would the simple answer be yes?
Okay. Yeah. I would say, I mean, I can elaborate a little bit on that. So, you know, in conjunction with our SR letters that we've issued, you know, a lot of the guidance actually refers back to the IIA standards. And in some cases, we do encourage, you know, banks to adopt the standards. And IIA is not just limited to banks.
It's
to, you know, different kind of industries. Now, one key thing that I specifically say this, you know, as you're aware, is the external quality assurance needs to happen every 5 years, and that's pretty standard across, you know, our guidances as well as other regulatory agencies as well. And I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Is there another part to your presentation or are there frequently asked questions, through your work with the banks that you encounter?
Yeah, there are. So on slide 23, here are just some frequently asked questions that I've received, throughout my time here at the Federal Reserve, and I wanted to share these with you. I believe I've covered a majority of these questions throughout my presentation. I just wanted to make sure that you have this good one-pager, if you're responsible for overseeing an audit function or if you're part of an audit function, whether it's, at a bank or, any other different kinds of business lines. And this will help you just kind of, question whether or not your audit department is doing the right thing and have these specific infrastructure in place.
Okay, earlier with respect to the section on governance and strategic objective, what is the role of internal audit in project management?
Okay, so I think in one of the previous slides I did mention that, yep. Internal audit should play a role as part of continuous monitoring. One is to stay informed on, what's happening with the business.
Yep.
And also they should track all major projects that are happening within institutions,
mm-hmm.
And would be expected actually to audit all the major areas for compliance. And bear in mind, audit does a risk focus type review, so they should make the appropriate enhancement and adjustments to the risk assessment as appropriate. And if there are any regulatory guidance that directs audit to evaluate certain processes, they should be expected to follow that guidance.
Okay, so is it internal audit's responsibility to ensure that the bank's project complies with, existing regulatory policies like Dodd-Frank Act and whether it's consistent with the firm's legal compliance department's interpretation of the rules. So this is kind of related to my previous questions in terms of, where audit sits in kind of a gray area between, compliance and legal and your own audit charter.
That is correct, though. I mean the first, as you previously mentioned, there's the first line of defense, second line, third line. Audit is basically your third line. So
right.
At the internal controls level, senior management should be very involved in project management because by the time audit comes in, it's, a little bit too late. But, I have seen at institutions where audit actually is a non-voting member in
mm-hmm.
any sort of pre-implementation work groups, and they would provide some kind of consulting-related advice to these work groups, telling them, hey, have you considered these new regulations that have come up? Please use these guidances to evaluate whether your processes are even in line or are you even doing the right thing. So, Dodd-Frank Act is one of them, and the other SR letter that we have is on outsourcing vendors. We have a couple of pages on vendor management. How do you even review vendor management and their process and everything else? So, there are guidances out there for both internal audit to use and also management to use.
And based on your observation, your personal opinion, with the supplemental letters and the revised requirements, what do you see are some of the major challenges that banks have in kind of implementing this? There obviously needs to be a high level of engagement with the business in terms of monitoring processes and even businesses. Do you find today there are sufficient resources in internal audit teams? Are they adequately trained? Do they have the relevant experience at the line level, at the business line level?
Well, there are a couple of points I want to make here. So first is just the SR 13-1 implementation on a very high level basis. Not going to institution specific, I want to say that, you know, we issued this guidance in 2013. You know, most of the institutions took, you know, the full year to implement this guidance, you know, to get everything up to speed, to define any gaps, and they were able to remediate that. Some institutions actually didn't do this in-house. They actually outsourced this SR 13-1 like gap analysis to a third-party vendor, you know, one of the big fours or an audit firm, for example, to help them understand what this SR 13-1 is about and how they can implement it quickly. Now, if there were any gaps in resources as a result of 13-1, the audit department has, you know, gone out and actually outsourced some of the audits. You know, predominantly the outsource efforts have been in the areas of compliance and information technology. With you know, emerging risks going around, you know, it's pretty common in those two areas that we see a lot of co-sourcing, outsourcing happened. Yeah, so they may not necessarily have the staff on board to execute the plan, but you know, there are specialists out there that they can hire.
Well, could you give some examples of you know, the outsourcing and how do the internal audit function manage this this outsource arrangement? Are some of the expertise or, you know, at some point in-house brought into the banks?
And I'm gonna give you a very good example. When Sarbanes-Oxley was when Sarbanes-Oxley was first implemented, you know, I was actually working in public accounting, and basically happened is we had to be the outsource arrangement for these banks because, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley was new to everybody. We didn't particularly know what the expectation was. I mean, PCAOB did outline X number of, you know, expectations for us, but, you know, we were helping banks trying to get up to speed with, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley, and that was a very tedious process. And the kind of same thing with this, any management of internal audit outsourcing arrangement, which is, you know, if you identify that you don't have the skill set, you go out and you find the skill set necessary to finish and complete your audit plan. And, you know, there are a lot of checkpoints when you're managing a vendor arrangement. First, you know, you get involved in the audit scoping process. You understand, you know, what the skill level is of the staff that's supporting your audit. You know, during different phases in the work paper review, you go in and you kind of question the auditor, you know, did we look at this? Did we think about this? You know, because by the time you come to the supervisory review process, it's a little bit too late on that end. And stay engaged throughout the review. And also, the CAE is actually supposed to provide, you know, active oversight over these outsourcing arrangements. You know, annually they have to assess whether or not they're meeting their internal audit standards. I mean, before they engage the vendor, they're supposed to go through bank standards and internal audit standards and also audit committee's approval in getting these outsourcing vendors into their workspace. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Kind of follow up to that, How long typically is that outsource period? Is it over 12 months, 24 months? Is it an ongoing engagement? And how much support does internal audit give to the external kind of auditor? Should that be evaluated?
Are you saying in terms of external auditor being the external CPAs, or are you talking external auditor as in the outsourcing arrangement?
External auditor as being the outsourced party.
The outsourced party. So can you repeat that question? I'm sorry.
Okay. Typically, how long is the engagement before the internal audit function, where you see examples where they may initially lack the resources or the right level of skill set? Typically, how long does it get kind of
remediated? Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to say, I don't like giving this answer, but I say it depends. So for example, if the entire audit function is outsourced to XYZ audit firm,
yeah,
it's normally over a year period, because normally typically you would finish your audit plan within the a year's worth. Now, there are instances where it's going to be months at a time. For example, you know, now the new hot topic is model validation. So we will go out and hire, mm-hmm, you know, expertise in that area, which a model validation audit should not take a year. It's going to take you a couple of months. Now, perhaps that vendor doesn't do any other audits besides model validation, so you will have to go out and find, you know, a separate audit firm to do your compliance review, and that might also take, you know, a couple of months at a time. So it depends on what the audit plan has laid out and what the budget and resources have been identified for that specific audit.
Okay, great. Thanks, mate. That I think pretty much answer all the questions. Okay, and that brings us to the end of this teleconsultation. May, I want to thank you for your insight and your presentation. It's been very insightful. You talk about a lot of practical issues that our banks in Asia can consider. You know, in terms of the implementation of guidelines and standards, I think the Federal Reserve kind of has got more granular requirements as compared to some of the kind of guidelines in this part of the world. To all our callers, we want to thank you for calling in, and we'd like you to join us to thank our speaker, May, for her insight today. A recording of this teleconsultation will be available on the Asian Banker website, so do visit the website if you'd like to listen to a playback of the session. We'd like to thank you again for calling in this morning. Until the next event, we wish you all